All right, welcome everyone to Didactic Mind, episode number 39. The father could not be reached for comment. Very warm welcome to all of my blog readers. Very warm welcome to all of my SoundCloud subscribers. I am Didact, and if you have not already hit the subscribe button, please make sure you do so. It will help me out a lot, and you will never miss a new podcast upload, whether it's the Didactic Mind series or the Domain Query series. Either one, you know, is full of information and ideas and reader requests and answers and such. And also, if you want to support my work, you want to make sure that I keep doing what I do, head on over to superbshaving.com. That's all one phrase, superbshaving.com. The link is in the description box. The latest post is up right now. I finished it yesterday. It's published. And it's all about helping men with sensitive skin get the most out of traditional wet shaving. You click on the affiliate links in that post and you'll be taken to an Amazon page where you can buy products that will I will get commission for it, and you'll really help me out in the process as I continue to build out my business ideas and ventures. So getting on to the big 4-0 right now, 40 episodes almost, will be 40 next week. And today I wanted to talk about the crisis of fatherlessness, or rather the effects of fatherlessness upon society. Now, I've talked a bit about this in tangential ways in the past, and I've referenced what a huge problem it is in Western society. But it seems particularly apropos to look at it right now, because of what we've been seeing over the past month or thereabouts, where we have seen significant evidence over the last 30 days, the last five, six weeks actually, of the effects of the lack of a strong father figure upon society. Now, this ties in as well with some of what I'm going to say ties in as well with what I referenced in my last Domain Query podcast, where I answered John C's questions about the various different generations and how they interact with each other and whether there's any hope or lack thereof for Gen Z, which is the latest cohort, and Gen Alpha, which is following, is really in its very early stages right now. And my answer to those questions, my answers to those questions, had to do with failed parenting strategies. That's not my term. It references something that someone named Simon Sinek talked about in a video that really went viral. I mean, it was a massive hit on YouTube. And it's all about the millennial generation. And you can go look it up. I'll stick it in the description box as well. Simon Sinek's video about millennials with his interview, during his interview with Tom Bilyeu. I mean, it's gotten, God only knows how many tens of millions of views by this point. The original video had something like 15 million views. And then they've had various iterations thereof, and various people have kind of edited it together. And basically, the point referenced in that video is the reason why millennials are in such a bad situation right now is because of failed parenting strategies. And I talked about this as well in my last Domain Query podcast, where I talked about how the baby boomers, and especially Gen Xers, have failed their children. Gen Xers may, well, probably actually violently disagree with that. And I understand why. I get it. Like, guys, I know why you would be so angry at me saying something like that. And that's fair. I mean, I understand the anger. Because Gen X grew up as the latchkey generation. They grew up as, the people who didn't have a stable family upbringing, a stable family life. They grew up as the children of divorce. They grew up as the children of narcissistic baby boomers. And they have been angry and cynical ever since. And you see that in the movies produced, especially during the 1980s, during the Brat Pack era. And they are very good movies. They are excellent movies, in fact. But they speak to the cynicism and world weariness of a generation that really kind of gave up on a lot of aspects of life. And that carried through into the 90s, where Gen X, I think, holds a lot of anger and resentment toward the baby boomers for the fact that the boomers didn't get out of the way and let Gen X take over and do what they needed to do. And that's also true. The baby boomers are still stubbornly clinging on to everything that they built up and everything that they acquired. The boomers would argue, well, we earned it. We worked hard. We sacrificed for it. So it's our right to stay and keep it. Yeah, okay. But when you have that narcissistic attitude, don't be surprised when you look out the window and you see people rioting and smashing stuff in the streets and you realize those are your kids out there. Gen X especially has been something of a failure when it comes to parenting, in large part because of those very same failed parenting strategies. It is not uncommon, as I said, to see Gen X parents going in with millennial kids into interviews and sitting down with their kids to make sure that they don't fail. It is not uncommon to find Gen X and baby boomer parents, going into like hand-holding their kids through various walks of life and being so-called helicopter parents. But the result of helicopter parenting has been disastrous. It has resulted in a coddled, weakened generation of young people out there on the streets who have unrealistic expectations of what life holds and who have never faced severe problems or trauma and have never really had to earn what they have. That's on one extreme. I mean, that's if you look at the people smashing and looting and burning stuff in the US and in many Western cities, that is one sort of aspect of their profile. My reckoning is that if you look at the distribution of incomes or family wealth from the people doing all this nonsense, you're going to find it as in many situations in life, it's a dumbbell shape, meaning that it has one hump at the low end and another hump at the high end, and there's not really a whole lot in between. And why is that? Well, the wealthiest kids who are out there, you know, smashing and burning stuff, have never really been disciplined. They've never been civilized by their parents. They've never had a strong father figure step in and tell them, shut up, sit down, do your homework, be a man, or, you know, act like a lady, that sort of thing. And I can't stress how important that is. And on the other end of the scale, you have people from, let's face it, lower socioeconomic status, low-end poverty and lack of wealth, lack of resources, lack of opportunities, doing much the same thing, expressing inchoate rage, but for very different reasons. The people at the high end of the income distribution act this way because they're, in large measure, bored and unhappy with their lives, and they fall for ideologies that prey on that unhappiness. The people at the low end have simply checked out of society altogether. In both cases, I believe the root cause is traced to fatherlessness. It's traced to a lack of a strong man in the house. Now, it's hard for me to talk about such things in anything. Whoops, there's a bug of some kind. It's hard for me to talk about anything related to such things. It's hard for me to relate to people who talk about not having a strong father figure in the house, because I did have a strong father in the house, or at least I had a strong father in my life. I still do. My dad has been an inspiration to me all my life. He's always been the man I've looked up to, and he's always been a source of strength and comfort when things have been rough, when things have been really, really hard. And he's, I think, surprisingly, given his character, probably the most understanding out of anybody in my family when things really went pear-shaped for me in 2018. He was by far the most willing to give me space and time to heal and recover. And the fact that I have not lived up to his expectations in pretty much any aspect of my life is not his fault, it's mine. So, you know, I had and I have a great dad, and he taught me a lot of things that are really important for a young man to know. He didn't teach me a lot, and to my great regret, you know, as I was growing up, he didn't teach me how to be handy with tools. He didn't teach me how to fight. He didn't teach me how to be strong physically. He didn't teach me a number of life skills that I now wish I had known at a much younger age. I kind of had to figure it out myself. And simple stuff like, how do you change the plunger in a toilet? How do you install a new shower head? How do you drill holes in a wall? How do you install a mounting bracket for a TV? How do you fix an electrical switch? How do you change the wires in a wall socket plug point without burning the house down? You know, I still haven't mastered that one, by the way. I did a very, very bad job of that a long time back, which the consequences of which are still felt to this day. And I really regret not having those skills. But my dad was always there when I needed him to be there. And you know, I grew up in a very stable, very, generally very happy two-parent household, which is a lot more than can be said for many of these kids. You know, my dad, to this day, carries tremendous guilt for being away for so much of my childhood. And I keep telling him, you know, there's nothing to be guilty about. You were out there doing a hard job, and you had to do what you did. And I bear no resentment whatsoever for that. And I never have, and I don't think I ever will. Because that's what a man is supposed to do. A man is supposed to provide for his family. But what you're looking at in the streets of Portland and Seattle and New York and Washington, D.C. and various San Francisco, Los Angeles, of course, is basically an epidemic, a pandemic of fatherlessness, of weak fathers raising over-entitled, snotty, bratty children who don't understand that they need to grow the hell up. And there's a lot of aspects you can look at in with respect to this. If you let's take the white kids for starters, who are out there smashing and looting and burning things, right? It's interesting to note that most of the people marching in these BLM protests, Black Looming Menace, basically, if you want to be deeply politically incorrect and call it what it is, are not actually black people. If you look at the actual people doing all the rioting and stupid nonsense, they are definitely disproportionately black. But if you look at the people doing the marching, the mostly, you know, as to quote the clown news network, these mostly peaceful protesters, which I don't think the CNN lol is ever going to live that one down. I mean, this soy boy gamma male reporter standing in front of a burning building and telling the audience, I want to emphasize, these are mostly peaceful protests. Yeah, my ass, they're mostly peaceful. You got a bloody burning building behind you, you moron. But that's what, if you look at the actual protests themselves, they're mostly comprised of whites. Why is it that white people, white kids are marching in favor of this stuff, when in reality, the actual roots of the BLM organization are Marxist, lesbian, globalist in every aspect. They are deeply and profoundly corrupt and evil people who founded a movement designed specifically to take advantage of white racial guilt. Why are they marching in favor of this? Partly it's because white people are uniquely susceptible to racial guilt. And I don't quite understand why that is. I mean, white people are the only people anywhere on earth that I've ever seen who really regret what they've done to other cultures. I don't get that. If you look at other cultures around the world, you will find not one hint of remorse from almost anyone about the atrocities that they have inflicted upon others. If you look at the Arab world, Arabs and Muslims in general do not care one whit about the fact that Islam has been the source of horror and genocide and slavery and mutilation and death and destruction for almost all of its 14th century existence, and almost 15 centuries now. They don't care about that. They don't care about the fact that the transatlantic slave trade was, in fact, spurred on by Muslim demand for slaves, Arab and Turkish Muslim demand for slaves. They don't care about that. They will never apologize for that. Because as far as they're concerned, it's written in their holy text. It's fine. You will not find very much regret from Indians for their caste system. Now, you will find some. I'm not saying it's non-existent because there are plenty of Indian members of the intelligentsia who will say the caste system is a terrible mistake. We have made a huge error in allowing it to persist, and it's completely incompatible with modern secular liberal democratic values. Well, that's true. You will find plenty of highly educated Indians who would say the same thing. I mean, I get that. But for the most part, if you're talking to the average Hindu on the street, he doesn't care about it. He's like, that's the way it is. That's life. That's our belief system. We accept it. It's ours, and we want to live under those conditions. Okay? You will not find very much regret or remorse from descendants of Aztecs for what they did to neighboring tribes. If you look at the Aztecs, the Olmecs, the Toltecs, the, whoever and whatever else, will you find them expressing much by way of regret for butchering and massacring their enemies, sacrificing them, cutting open their chests with obsidian knives, yanking out their hearts, still beating hearts and holding them up to the sun, and watching as the blood spurts out? No. Will you find them apologizing for the fact that they would toss young couples into a bonfire, still alive, by the way, fully conscious, to burn to death, and then eat their limbs with lime, chilies, and salt? No. Would you find black people in Africa willing to apologize for selling, for the fact that their ancestors sold their kin into slavery? No. Would you find descendants of basically Maoris in New Zealand willing to apologize for their cannibalistic tendencies, the cannibalistic tendencies of their ancestors? No. As far as they're concerned, that's part of their history and their culture, and they accept that. Why is it that white people are so uniquely susceptible to apologizing profusely for the sins of their fathers? What's up with that? I don't get it. And I don't think most people around the world who are not white would get it, because it makes no sense. You are responsible for what you have done wrong, not for what your great 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 grandfather has done wrong or did wrong. There is no justification for holding the great 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 grandson responsible for what the ancestor did. It makes absolutely no sense. You are responsible for what you've done, not for what your ancestors did. But white people have this unique and strange quality about them, and it is both infuriating and endearing. Whites are, in my experience, the least racist and least xenophobic people I've ever seen, that I've ever met. Which is why, when I see white kids marching in the streets demanding racial justice, I'm like, what are you marching for? You've already achieved it. Your society is the most colorblind, most equalitarian, most decent, and most welcoming society of any anywhere in the world. You've achieved what you want. So stop smashing stuff, stop burning stuff. It's silly. Now, what you're looking at there is an abdication by fathers to civilize their children, of their duty to civilize their children. Why is that? If you look at the kids who are out there, many of them, most of them are from the millennial generation, and the millennial generation is notable for having very weak parents. Now, the root causes of that among the whites are fairly clear. For the last 50 years, we have been taught the poison of feminism. We have been taught that women are better than men, that women can do everything that men can do, which they can't, that women are just as strong and just as tough and just as capable as men, which they're not. We've been taught that women should be given preferential treatment ahead of men, which is a direct logical contradiction of what I just said, and women are therefore entitled to protections that men don't have. Okay, how does that work? The result has been the steady erosion and degradation of a father's rights, to the point where fathers have often given up under threat of tremendous pressure, under threat of coercion and under tremendous pressure from the culture and from a court system that is totally stacked against them. There's a video from Joker of Better Bachelor, and it's really worth listening to and watching in full because it talks about lawyers in the court system discussing what goes on in family court. Family court is not the same as regular court, as criminal court. Okay, family court is a parallel court system set up outside the confines of the criminal court, criminal justice system. And it is totally, totally against the father and against men. It's a system designed to denude men of their rights, to take away their children, to take away their families, to destroy their lives completely. In the US, it's an absolute human rights disaster. And the result has been that, number one, men are simply refusing to get married and have children. And number two, men who do get married have all too often simply abdicated their roles as parents and masculine fathers. This has been nothing short of an utter disaster. And if you don't believe me, you know, you don't have to, watch the video from Joker, read a book called The Predatory Female by Reverend Lawrence E. Shannon, great book, in which the Reverend himself, by the way, a devout Christian, and therefore a strong advocate of family values and marriage and patriarchy, basically tells his parishioners, he says at the end, "I tell my parishioners, don't get married." It's like, what? You're a Christian pastor, how on earth can you tell people that? And he says it because marriage has been removed from a covenant between man, woman, and God to a covenant between man, woman, and state. And the moment you introduce that third party, the state, in the middle of it all, you get very, very, very dangerous outcomes. You get an incredibly risky situation where a man is signing over his future happiness, his income, his wealth, his children, to the caprices of a woman who is encouraged, actively encouraged by the state to rip his wallet out through his genitals. Okay? That's the state of things right now. And the result, when you combine that with the results of 50 years of feminization, 50 years of government social engineering, and 50 years of male abdication of their roles as traditional providers and breadwinners, you have a spoiled, rotten generation of millennials who are out there in the streets protesting imaginary injustices for the most part, which really have no bearing on the real world. That's the white kids, okay? They are spoiled by weak fathers. It is not coincidental that the last 20 or 30 years or so have seen a dramatic spike in the number of what Vox Dei calls gamma males. Gamma males are despicable. They have their place. They have a rightful place in the hierarchy, the socio-sexual hierarchy. But they're supposed to be limited in number. If you look at the socio-sexual hierarchy, you have the alphas, the top dogs, the leaders, the natural, absolute out and out strong men who rule over everything. A great example, the quintessential example. His most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, the Lion of Midnight, may the Lord bless him and preserve him. Ur Alpha, original grade A Alpha, right there. He is Alpha male, qua Alpha male, okay? Another great example, St. Ronald Magnus of the Right, Ronaldus Triumphus. Reagan was a true Alpha male, and there's no one can debate that. Interestingly, though, unlike Trump, Reagan was faithful to one woman for most of his life. I mean, obviously he had a wife before he met Nancy, but with Nancy Reagan, his life was complete, and he lived very, very happily with Nancy for the rest of his days. Another great example of a stone-cold, lethal alpha male, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. Very, very scary guy. Don't mess with him. But unquestionably a leader among leaders. Okay? Then you have the Bravos, the second-tier rank, and I won't expound too deeply on the hierarchy because most people who read my work already know it. The Bravos are the lieutenants, the guys who happily protect their alpha, their leader, and keep an eye out for him and obey his instructions. Classic example of a good Bravo, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, most likely. Then you have the Deltas. The Deltas are just the worker bees, the guys who get things done and who demand to be respected for their work, who demand, above all, respect and recognition for doing a good job. These guys are the backbone of society. They absolutely drive and maintain all of society. These are the guys like, you want a political figure, Dr. Ben Carson. Perfect example of a Delta. Loyal, hardworking, uncompromising in his ethics and values, extremely talented, but just a really quiet, unassuming guy. Just wants to get on with his job. Great. Then you have the Gammas. These are the all too often very introverted, very snarky, physically weak, sexually unsuccessful, and deeply problematic people. They can never be wrong in their own minds, and they can never ever be seen to fail, because failure in their eyes is mortifying, it's humiliating, far beyond the degree that it would be to most ordinary men. These are the people who undermine institutions and all too often open up avenues for SJW attacks and convergence. And if you find gamma males running around in your organization, you've got a big problem. Gamma males make horrible bosses, they make terrible husbands, they make awful fathers, because they are weak. They are mentally and physically, usually physically, very weak. Classic example of a gamma male, John Scalzi. Perfect, right there. I mean, you could not gamma harder if you tried. And then, of course, you have the Omegas, who have completely ruled themselves out of society, just voluntarily detached themselves. Well, actually, they haven't voluntarily detached themselves. They are rejected by society in general. And this is where you get the problem of mass shooters and incels. That's really where it comes from. Gammas tend to be incel, involuntarily celibate. Omegas are incels both by choice and by general societal consensus. What you're seeing right now is in the streets of places like Minneapolis, Portland, Seattle, etc., is the results of gamma male parenting on gamma male children. When you have a weak father, a boy grows up without understanding how to rein in his masculinity. Masculinity is not toxic, regardless of what the feminazis might think. And actually, by the way, calling a feminist a Nazi is an insult to the National Socialist Workers' Party of Germany, as Vox Day has said many times. The feminists have killed far more people than Nazis ever did, and they have been far more destructive to society than Nazis ever were. It's not to say that Nazi for the binary thinkers out there, I mean, not to belabor the point, but that does not mean Nazis are a good thing. Nazis are horrible. Nazis are terrible. I'm saying feminists are worse. Okay? Just so we're clear. When you have weak fathers, the result is weak sons who don't know how to channel their masculine aggression. Testosterone defines us as men. It is literally the hormone that creates us as men. To regulate it and to channel it, you need the influence of a strong father figure who gives a boy, through force of personality and example, a template upon which he can build and create his own archetype, his own experiences. When he can do that, when he can regulate his passions and his emotions, he becomes extraordinarily strong. But when he can't do that, when his emotions are either suppressed by too strong a father figure, or left unchecked entirely by too weak a father figure, that's when damage accumulates over time. When you have a man whose emotions are too repressed, it makes him unable to express his anger easily. It makes him unable to lash out when he needs to. He just sort of sits there and swallows whatever he gets. And that builds up tremendous rage and resentment inside of him, and he lashes out in ways that are incredibly destructive when he shouldn't. There are times when it is entirely appropriate to express anger and rage and frustration. There are times when it's appropriate to smash things and break things, because it's better to smash things and break things in the confines of your own home than to smash things and break things when rioting in the streets or when taking out your rage and frustration upon people who are weaker than you, upon women and children. That's where a lot of domestic abusers get their problems from. They don't know how to express their anger properly. So they take it out on people who can't fight back easily. And that's why it happens. It's all too often you have weak fathers who cause that problem. You have emotionally suppressive fathers who cause that problem. When it comes to the other end of the scale with weak fathers, they never know how to rein in their children. They never civilize them. They never just smack the kids over the heads and say, "Don't be such an idiot," you know. Or they never beat their sons and tell them, "Stop acting out like this." And you don't have to physically beat your son. I'm not saying that. That's not what I'm advocating for. I'm saying, they never discipline their sons. Beat is the wrong word. They don't discipline their sons adequately. You don't have to hit your children. Sometimes it's necessary, and I'm not saying it should be thrown out. You know, corporal punishment should not be thrown out of the window as it has been in Western society. I do believe there's a place for it. And in this respect, I differ significantly from some of my own relatives who disagree and don't want corporal punishment. I think that there is a place for it. But when you don't have corporal punishment as an option, when you remove it entirely, you get, or when you don't have any form of discipline even, you get wild, uncivilized sons who go out there and don't know how to rein in their aggression. And that's exactly what you're seeing among a lot of the white protesters out there right now. When it comes to the black protesters, who are on the other end of that dumbbell-shaped distribution that I talked about, what are you looking at? You're looking at the results of 50 years of dis-civic, dis-genic social engineering, where the black propensity toward dis-civic behavior has been magnified and amplified to the point where it's out of control now. This is remarkable. I mean, it's astonishing, and it's a harbinger of America's future, because the very same policies that have destroyed black society, the very same traits that have destroyed black society, are embedded within the social engineering of white society right now. If you look at black society in the US, the transformation that has occurred over 100 years is horrifying. Jason Riley, who worked for the Wall Street Journal, I think he still works there actually, wrote a book called Please Stop Helping Us. And in it, I haven't read it, but in it he talks about the social engineering policies that have led black society down the cesspit of decay and degradation that it finds itself in today. Now, this is the standard conservative, cuck-servative answer to the problems of black society, that it's all a bunch of liberal policies that have created perverse incentives that have resulted in the destruction of the black nuclear family, and so on and so forth. That's true. That's partly true. But it's not the whole story. IQ and heredity also play a big part in that. And so does the impact of segregation. Now, I'm not calling for segregation. I never have. I've never called for forced segregation. I don't believe that forced segregation of the kind that you had with apartheid or with Jim Crow laws in the South is justified or right. I don't believe in that. I do believe in voluntary separation. I do think that if people want to live in their own communities, they have the right to do so. And I believe that anyone who disagrees with me is a colossal hypocrite. Because if you look at places where the intelligentsia, the educated elite live, they're some of the most segregated places anywhere on earth. They always live in gated communities. Why is that? Because they don't want to be around the influences of black so-called civilization. Here's the reality of black civilization in the US. Blacks have been systematically incapable of maintaining their own civilization for the better part of 50 years. And it actually stretches back farther than that. Now, how do you reconcile that that statement with the fact, and it is a fact, that black people, between sort of 1870 and 1920, or 1930 actually, were the most intact society in America? Black out-of-wedlock births in that time span were lower than white out-of-wedlock birth rates. Black marriage rates were higher. Black church attendance rates were much higher. They were the most religious and most the most socially cohesive community in America. What the hell happened? Well, a clue lies in the fact that black crime rates were always higher than white crime rates. Always. Another clue lies in the fact that black average IQs have always been lower, significantly lower than white American IQs. The average IQ in America is about 100. But the average white American IQ is about 103. The average black IQ is about 85. This has been tested and shown repeatedly in study after study after study. It is, for all of America's efforts to change and fix the problem, an ineradicable, irreducible difference between black and white people. You can't get over it. What does that mean? Well, among other things, it means that the black ability to maintain some of the higher aspects of civilization is much reduced compared to white Americans. Coming back to the issue of crime rates, if you look at black crime in their own neighborhoods, it was always higher than white crime. If you look at black misbehavior in those neighborhoods, why was it so relatively restrained, though? Well, it's because they were surrounded by white people who did not put up with any nonsense. That disappeared after the 1960s, and we now have a complete moral and governmental and social inversion, where black misbehavior is not only encouraged, or not only tolerated, it is encouraged. This has been nothing short of a disaster, and it has resulted in some of the most abjectly pitiful acts of surrender I've ever seen in my life. I mean, I cannot tell you how angry it makes me when I see white people being approached on the streets. You can find these videos on YouTube, they're all over there. And blacks approach whites and tell them, kneel down in front of me and apologize for the sins of racism. Apologize for being a racist because you're white. I really want to slap some of these white people and tell them, what are you apologizing for? You're not a racist. Stop pretending that you have something to apologize for, to atone for. Stand up for yourself, stand up for your people and your community. But they won't do it. And the reason they won't do it is because blacks themselves can get away with it. why can they get away with it? A big part of that has to do with fatherlessness. If you look at the black community, the out-of-wedlock birth rate is something on the order of 70 to 80%, depending on who you're talking to. If you're looking at the way in which black men father children, it is very common, far too common, for them to have multiple children with multiple women. The divorce rate among black couples is astronomically high. If you look at pairings between men and women of different races and ethnicities, black woman, black man, these days is, what, a better than 50% chance of ending in divorce. I've got the statistics somewhere, I can't remember exactly. But the divorce rates are crazy high. And that's partly because of social engineering and partly because of culture. Not everything is due to social engineering. Yes, there is a distinct pressure upon lower income families for women to divorce their men and thereby get a larger social stipend in the process. This was referenced all the way back in 1964 by then private citizen Ronald Reagan in his October 27th, 1964 speech at the Republican National Convention, in which he talked about a time for choosing. And he talked about exactly this phenomenon. There's a section of that speech, you got to read the whole thing, it's absolutely brilliant, where he talks about the fact that there's this one woman who had, I think, six children, was pregnant with her seventh, and was talking to her friend about divorcing her husband because if she did so, she would get a larger child allowance from the government. That is social engineering designed specifically to keep low-income families from having a father in the house, from having a man in the house. It's the substitution of by government for a father, and that is disastrous, no matter how you look at it. But the thing is, it's not uncommon among blacks in general. If you removed all of that government apparatus, put it another way, if you got rid of all of that government apparatus and just ditched it entirely and said to black people and low-income people in general, you're on your own, you got to figure it out for yourselves, would that magically overnight solve the problem of black fatherlessness? No. For that, you have to look to Africa. Exact same problem, exact same issue, no social safety net to cover for it. Why do you see the same thing in two supposedly completely different populations? Why is that? Now, I'm not enough of a social scientist to figure that out, and I doubt too many social scientists would be keen on doing so, because it's a very scary, quote-unquote, topic of conversation. But it's worth looking into, because while black populations in the U.S. have about an 85 average IQ, and that is in large part due to the fact that, genetically speaking, blacks in America are roughly, what, the last figure I saw was something around 20% white, actually, in terms of ancestry. If you look at their DNA, about 20% of their DNA is from white Europeans, white European stock. In sub-Saharan Africa in particular, the average IQ is 70. You could argue, and you would make a rational argument, that a lot of that is due to malnutrition. Once you get rid of malnutrition, average IQ jumps up significantly. You could also argue, and it is a very good argument, that IQ is not the sole determinant of everything. I agree with that. It's not. I am not an HBD advocate. I do not believe that IQ is the sole determinant of success or failure for civilization. At least one great counterexample, the South American nation of Colombia, average IQ of about 82, yet it's fully capable of maintaining first world infrastructure and maintaining a high functioning civilization. So IQ is not the only determinant, but it is a big one. And culture is another major determinant. Blacks in America keep talking about how, particularly the militant blacks, keep talking about how basically black society in Africa achieved untold glories and wonders, the We Was Kangs argument. And they resort to the evidence that there was a Nubian dynasty, a black African Nubian dynasty in charge of Egypt way back when. And that's true, there was. That being said, what exactly has black civilization achieved in general? Answer, not a whole lot. What it has achieved, at least in the USA, is epic levels of fatherlessness, epic levels of crime, and a very clear break between black society and white society. It's become very, very clear that blacks no longer want to be part of white society in general. There are exceptions. There are plenty of exceptions. There are lots of exceptions, okay? There are lots and lots of people in black America who just want to be left in peace. They want to run their stores. They want to set up their own businesses. They want to live peacefully. They have nothing against their white neighbors, and that's all to the good. That's, you know, these are good people. There's nothing whatsoever wrong with them. And by all means, you know, let them interact with white neighbors and with Asians and Hispanics and whatever, because they're exactly the kind of people that the rest of us want to be around. They are civilized, they are decent, they are hardworking, they are caring, they are Christian. That's great. You know, by all means, welcome them into your life, because these are good people, regardless of what they look like. It just doesn't matter. But there is also a significant number of black people who want nothing to do with white society. Those blacks call for their own country and their own place, and they've been doing so for some time, and they've made their frustrations and anger with the existing state of things abundantly clear over the last 6 weeks by smashing and breaking things. If that's the case, by all means, let there be peaceful separation. Because it is clear that that society and white society cannot coexist side by side. Or intermingled, I should say. They may be able to coexist side by side as long as each side is distinct and clear. As long as that separation is voluntary, I'm all for it. I think it is necessary for the United States to break up into different constituent countries occupying the current physical landmass of the USA, and for each of those nations to go their own way and do their own thing. And if one of those nations happens to be majority black, well, okay, fine, let them. But then the majority white nation that would result, the majority sort of ancestrally European nation that would result, should close its borders to them. There's just as the majority black nation should close its borders to everybody else. That's the only way this problem is going to get solved. Because if it's not resolved that way, it's going to become just more and more violent, anarchic, and painful for everybody else. Paul Kersey, whose blog, Stuff Black People Don't Like, is quite scary to read in a lot of ways, and whose writing is very difficult to read. I can't stand how much he misspells things. I mean, in an age of spell check, he can't do basic grammar and spelling checks. I remember trying to read one of his books on Kindle, on my Amazon Kindle, like 10 years ago, and I just couldn't get through it because it was just so appallingly badly edited. But the basic point that he makes is very clear. Essentially, there is what you would call the black undertow, which consists of what happens when black people move into white neighborhoods. It's a very predictable cycle, and it's very, very visible. Whites establish clear functional civilization, high-level civilizations, wherever they go. Blacks move in, because, you know, whites are not particularly discriminatory. They're like, yeah, okay, fine, you know, if you can afford the house, move in, buy it, so on. And over time, what happens? That suburb becomes noisy, drugs flood the streets, you get violence, you get loud block parties late at night, property values plummet, whites start packing up their bags and leaving, and the decline rapidly accelerates. And you see it time and time and time and time and time and time again in formerly prosperous neighborhoods. You wouldn't believe it today, but if you look at the Bronx 100 years ago, the Bronx used to be the playground for the rich and famous of Manhattan, right? That's where the rich people had their summer houses. That's where they would go to escape from the pressures of the city. New Orleans used to be a vibrant you know, melting pot of various ethnicities and cultures, and it used to be predominantly white in the city center. Now, not so much. Detroit is another, is like the perfect example. Detroit's city center was considered the Paris of the Midwest. It was considered one of the most remarkable urban success stories of all time. Then the race riots in the 1960s happened. The city went from a population of 800,000, something like that, close to a million people, to barely 300,000 today. And it is 90% black. Camden, New Jersey, which is just an absolutely horrible, awful place, 90%+ black. Okay. And it looks like it was hit by an atom bomb. I mean, I've been there a few times. It's a scary place. I don't recommend going there. The only reason anyone goes to Camden who isn't from that area is because of the concert hall near the river. I saw an Iron Maiden concert there, and I saw a Rush concert there, and I saw a couple of other... Yeah, that was it, actually. Just those two, I think. That's the only reason to be there. Nobody else wants to be there for any reason. Okay? That's what it's like in city after city in the United States with majority black populations. And it's a scary thought. This isn't how it should be. This isn't how any of us want it to be. But it is how it is. The reason you're seeing this is because blacks don't have fathers in the home teaching them how to be civilized. And even if they did, would that work? I don't know. The evidence suggests not. I want to finish with a point that may have escaped some people listening to this. What you're seeing in black America today is the future of white America tomorrow. The results of fatherlessness in black America are very visible and very scary. Rampant drug use, extreme underperformance in school, very high likelihood of ending up in jail. I mean, if you look at the population of people in jail right now, what do you see? Most of the black men who ended up in jail didn't have strong fathers in the home. I mean, it's like the correlation is stunning. Mass shootings are another direct result of fatherlessness. And this is not necessarily a black problem. It is a black problem because the number of black mass shootings goes criminally underreported, literally criminally underreported. But if you look at white shooters, in school shootings and such, what is the number one predictor of a white kid going postal and shooting up his classmates? It is not weak gun control laws. That's bullshit. It's, gun control, it's actually the opposite. Weak gun control laws in a state make it less likely for shootings to happen. Why? Because you know that the people around you are likely to be carrying, they're likely to be packing. If you're on a university campus or a school or whatever, and there are security guards or there are teachers armed with pistols, that is a tremendous deterrent to mass shooters. Weak gun control laws result in lower mass shootings. And the evidence on that, if you look at John Lott's work and various other papers published on this subject, the evidence on that is absolutely categorical. There's no questioning it anymore. On the other hand, what is the number one predictor of a white kid or a black kid or, you know, of any race going postal? Every single time, virtually, weak father or non-existent father in the home. Every single time. Bill Whittle did a great video about this called It's the Steel, Stupid, or something like that, in which he talked about this exact issue. The problem is not guns in America. The problem is lack of fathers. There was a horrifying case across the pond in the UK, PC Andrew Harper's death, where the police constable or the policeman approached a gang of travellers. This is the polite term in the UK for basically white trash, as they are called in the US. People who live in the equivalent of trailer parks, in mobile camper vans and such, and wander around the countryside and make their livings. The people that are referred to as travelers in the UK are considerably worse in many ways than rednecks and white trash in the US. these are people who make their livings from stealing stuff from other people, and they have largely checked out of society completely. A few of these youths were stopped in a car by a policeman, and they basically drove off wildly. There was a rope of some kind trailing behind the car. It got looped around the constable's ankles, and he tripped and he fell, and he was dragged for something like over a mile across some very, very rough ground. The details of the case are absolutely horrifying. When the car finally came to a stop, it looked like, because the body had been flayed alive, the man had been flayed alive. Now, it's thought that, mercifully, he lost consciousness almost immediately when he fell. Thank God for that, because his face was ripped away, much of his skin was missing, the body was totally naked, the clothes had all been ripped off, the skin was mostly gone from the corpse. All he had on was his socks, basically. And if you read the description of the defendants, they are basically, they're teenagers. They are illiterate. They can't read or write. They make their living from stealing stuff and from hooliganism, basically. They are in every way rejects from society. And in every way, the results of fatherlessness, of lawlessness. I want to leave off with a key point. Fathers are the law. Fathers are civilizing. If you make conditions impossible for fathers to exist, you get a lawless and broken society. That's exactly what you're seeing right now. And you're going to be in serious trouble when it comes time to try to restore law and order, because there is no one to do the restoration. I'm going to leave it at that. Been rambling on for long enough. I hope I've given you some interesting things to think about. Once again, please visit superbshaving.com. Please visit the blog. I'd be delighted if you stop by and leave a comment there, and keep the dialogue going. Make sure that you subscribe to this podcast, and that way you'll never miss any new uploads. And thank you, as always, for your patronage. I will leave links to the various works and books that I've referenced, both in the description box and on my blog, so you can go check it out for yourself. And as always, stay well, stay safe, regardless of where you come from, regardless of where you're listening. Be careful out there. It's a very rough and scary world, but have hope and do not despair, because we are being tested, we are being pushed, and we're not going to enjoy the results of those tests, but we are going to come through them eventually, one way or another. So don't lose hope, because there is always hope to be found. This is Didact, and this has been Didactic Mind, episode 39, The Father Could Not Be Reached for Comment.